Jerry? Okay. Well, I think we can all agree from what we've observed so far that physics and metaphysics are essentially inseparable, and metaphysical worldview issues can't be separated from the practice of science, nor should they be, but especially in the area of cosmology. So scientific neutrality, as such, is really a myth, and that much is unavoidable. So, but still, there's kind of a reciprocal relationship between metaphysics and physics, in which metaphysics may constrain theorization, and physics can lead to the elaboration and restructuring of metaphysics in the way that we conceptualize the world. Now, the fundamental question that we want to look at is whether the ultimate explanatory principle of the universe is to be found in matter operating autonomously or in mind. And so we arrive at the great divide. If you affirm the primacy of mind, a theistic worldview, then the universe has a transcendent intelligent cause of some sort. There is a fundamental ultimate dependence and ultimate sense of causal insufficiency to the material realm. And the universe and humanity have a purpose. If you affirm the ultimacy of matter, you're left with evolutionary naturalism, and that implies the self-sufficiency and causal closure of the material realm, strictly naturalistic principles of development, and an absence of any universal significance to it all. Now let's talk about the influence of naturalism in multiverse cosmology. As Bernard Carr summarizes it, to the hardline physicist, the multiverse may not be entirely respectable, but at least it's preferable to invoking a creator. Indeed, anthropically inclined physicists like Leonard Susskind and Steven Weinberg are attracted to the multiverse precisely because it seems to dispense with God as the explanation of cosmic design. So that, I think, has motivated a lot of the research in multiverse cosmology. Not all people approach it that way. Of course, Jerry doesn't. But I do think that in the larger physics community, that's the kind of thinking that is going on. So we can ask the question, is there a theistic version of the multiverse? Certainly the idea of a multiverse is not intrinsically incompatible with theism. It's certainly within God's power to have created more than one universe. And the proposed mechanisms of universe generation are themselves, you could say, as subject to rather tight design constraints within M-theory. If we understood M-theory better, at least, I think we might find that it has a very specific form that it has to take in order to be a universe-generating mechanism. Nonetheless, those mechanisms also raise some peculiar theological issues, and Rob Mann raised these questions earlier in relation to incarnational theology, the doctrine of salvation, the metaphysics of personal identity, given the reliance on the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics and quantum cosmology, and the unbounded redundancy of physical states of affairs brought about by chaotic eternal inflation. So we need to be sensitive to those sorts of concerns. Furthermore, you don't get any factory warranties from Multiverse Incorporated. Under the current hypotheses for randomized universal production, other universes manufactured are overwhelmingly pointless. Many recollapse quickly, fizzling into nothingness. Many are empty and devoid of matter and form. Many are kind of chaotic monstrosities. Purposeful, ordered universes are a negligible fraction of the whole. So our universe, on this view, would be an infinitesimal corner of purpose and light in the midst of infinite chaos and old night, so to speak. And that's not the conception of an endless universe reflecting the glory of God. The metaphor of God as an artist seems sound, but his artistry isn't the undirected chaos of a Jackson Pollock, as the multiverse proposals would imply, but the focused brilliance and skill of a Da Vinci or Michelangelo or a Rembrandt. So in short, current multiverse proposals are not testimonies to God's maximal greatness and inventiveness, I don't think, Jerry, but insofar as they're coherent, they're testimonies to the blind roll of the dice. So should we baptize the multiverse? Well, Arthur Holmes, a retired philosophy professor from Wheaton, famously said, "All truth is God's truth." But he didn't mean by that that it wasn't intended to be an avenue to baptizing whatever the current fad in scientific theorizing happened to be, but rather a statement of whatever is metaphysically the case, whether we recognize it or not, is so because God has either actively made it to be so or permitted it to be so. So in short, multiverse cosmology doesn't get a pass for baptism until it's successfully completed confirmation class. Given its atheistic cachet and theologically problematic status, passing confirmation class in this context would mean providing an explanation that's empirically and conceptually superior to that of a first order as opposed to meta-level intelligent cosmological design. So what are we looking at? And with apologies, if you came of age in the early 1980s, you probably remember the song Money for Nothing with Dire Straits. So this is the Dire Straits multiverse. Quantum cosmology is supposed to give you universes for nothing, chaotic for free, and the string landscape gives you laws and constants on the MTV, by which I mean multiple trials for viability. Okay, so let's take it from the top. We're going to take a look at multiverse explanations. These are the sort of questions that we have in the background. What are the natural phenomena that lead to them and the assumptions motivating the strategy? What are the proposed mechanisms? What are the assumptions governing these mechanisms and their operation? What explanatory power does the strategy have? And what are the implications of accepting that mode of explanation for the nature and practice of science? So, as Jerry was mentioning, there's a theorem by Bord, Guth, and Vilenkin that has gone through several iterations, closing loopholes, that shows that, of course, in the classical general relativistic case, the Hawking-Penrose theorems show that there's an absolute beginning and a singularity. The BGV theorem shows that all inflationary spacetimes have a beginning in the finite past. And if it exists, it's quite likely that the multiverse had a beginning. So string landscape scenarios satisfy the BGV theorem. The cyclic ekpyrotic model that Jerry focused on for a while, also the aboriginal brains satisfy the BGV theorem. And if you try to do an end run around that with something like a primordial string perturbative vacuum, as the pre-Big Bang inflationary model does, it is metastable throughout, and that implies in turn that it couldn't be infinitely old. So many cosmologists, recognizing, okay, the universe or the multiverse has a beginning, insist that a different physics is required at the beginning, some sort of quantum nucleation event that requires the resources of quantum cosmological description. So it's a common sense truth to most of us that whatever begins to exist has a cause. But some physicists appeal to the acausal descriptions of quantum mechanics as evidence of the existence of uncaused material events. So you find physicists like Frank Wilczek and Michio Kaku, and particularly Vic Stenger, who's one of the new atheists, making extraordinary claims like nothing as a state is unstable. And consequently, the random appearance of things like universes are just one of those things that happen from time to time with a quantifiable degree of probability, of course. Well, let's talk a little bit about the difference between prediction and explanation in quantum physics. It's true that all quantum theories predict quantum tunneling, instantaneous jumps from one quantum state to another, for no discernible physical reason. Many quantum physicists have become so inured to such phenomena that they've arrived at the belief that some things in nature happen without a cause and for no reason at all. That we can predict what will take place with a certain probability, but if it does, nothing caused it. So quantum theories of physical phenomena provide mere mathematical descriptions that in many cases allow for very precise predictions, but they provide absolutely no understanding of why or how such phenomena are possible. So there's a difference between prediction and explanation. A prediction tells you what will or may happen if certain conditions are satisfied. An explanation tells you why it is so. Quantum theories and physics provide mathematical descriptions that allow predictions of measurement outcomes to be made, but they do not, by themselves, provide any explanation for why the specific outcomes we observe have come about or how they're even possible. Now, that situation worried Einstein, and as a consequence, he argued that the existence of non-local correlations in quantum mechanics showed that it was incomplete as a physical theory. Subsequent to that original argument, careful argumentation by John Bell and subsequent meticulous experimentation have shown that quantum theory is accurate, and in essence, Einstein was wrong on that point. So when the implications of such non-locality are combined with those of various non-localizability results for unobserved quanta and the failure of identity and individuation criteria with respect to material objecthood in quantum statistics, exemplified, for example, by superpositions of particle number in quantum field theories, the proper conclusion seems to be that incompleteness is not the property of quantum theory, but of physical reality itself. The universe and its operative principles are not causally self-sufficient, and therefore the universe itself is not causally closed. So the demonstrable absence of physical explanations for quantum events doesn't mean that these events lack a cause, merely that whatever explains them is not physical in nature. And this carries with it a further and even more valuable lesson, namely that evolutionary naturalism is not tenable as a worldview. In his book, A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking asks an insightful question, and he doesn't give an answer to it. He asks, what is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? As a matter of logic, mathematical descriptions may have different metaphysical implications, but they don't function as efficient causes, either metaphysical or material. They're causally inert. When quantum cosmology describes space-times as tunneling into existence from a highly constrained nothingness, or from another vacuum state, or relativistic quantum field theory describes matter as popping out of a quantum vacuum, neither provide an explanation, let alone an efficient cause for such happenings. At best, if they're applicable at all, they just provide a description of a process. So the belief that such descriptions show that the universe does not have and does not need a cause is a non sequitur, and it runs counter to everything else that we know. It's fair to say, then, that the demise of efficient material causality in fundamental physics and quantum cosmology reveals the limits of naturalistic explanation and the need for explanation in terms of a transcendent intelligent cause. That's what rationality demands, and indeed, it's the only basis on which we should expect nature to be orderly and intelligible to the human intellect at all. We can talk a little bit about the shortcomings of the Hartle-Hawking model and the constraints that it places on superspace, which is the highly structured mathematical space of all curved three-dimensional spaces and their correlation with matter configurations on those spaces. Those have to be constrained in very specific ways in order to get a distribution that makes our universe's geometry one of the most probable to come out of quantum cosmology. So there's a lot of, if you like, intelligently designed constraints in the background. You're not getting the universe for nothing. The background mathematical space has a lot of information packed into it. Furthermore, it depends, if you're going to buy into quantum cosmology, on a realistic interpretation of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics in the Feynman path integral formulation. Every possible outcome of every quantum process is realized in actuality, but occurs in a different parallel universe empirically inaccessible to our own. Now, aside from the ontologically profligate, untestable and generally unwarranted and deeply implausible character of the many worlds resolution of the measurement problem, it also suffers from intractable technical difficulties. First of all, it renders the unequal outcome probabilities of quantum theory unintelligible. And since there are infinitely many ways to decompose the quantum state of the universe into a superposition of orthogonal states, the choice of decomposition and its accompanying ontology are completely arbitrary. And then when you start talking about Euclideanization of the space in which you're doing your calculations, that's a mere computational expedient. You don't, by Euclideanizing, prove that the universe had no beginning because there's no singularity at the beginning of time. Rather, you're moving through a computational space that allows the path integral to be convergent. And that suggests that, or the suggestion that we should interpret that Euclideanization realistically as obviating an initial singularity and avoiding a universal beginning is disingenuous. Transformation back into real time and a Lorentzian metric is necessary to describe the space-time in which we live, and that restores the singularity and the absolute beginning to the universe at which the laws of physics break down. Finally, Alex Vilenkin summed things up in 2010. He's a quantum cosmologist. He deeply regrets this. An important point is that an observational test of quantum cosmology doesn't seem possible. Thus, sadly, quantum cosmology is not likely to become an observational science. In short, with all of these things considered, quantum cosmology seems a pretty bad bet. All right, chaotic eternal inflation, initial conditions for free. Alan Guth introduced this concept back in 1981 or so, in an attempt to explain the smoothing out of the universe's initial conditions by pushing irregular values out beyond the range of the observable universe. And so he was addressing the horizon problem, characterized by the uniformity of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the flatness problem, in terms of the ratio of the actual mass density of the universe to its critical mass density, and also the absence of magnetic monopoles predicted by favored grand unified theories. So given that Rob talked about this a bit, I'm going to skip over some of the details. But let's start talking about the assumptions that feed into the theory and its implications. Is it free of arbitrary assumptions? Well, no. The inflaton fields were invented to solve a particular problem, and they have no intrinsic connection to other fields in physics. They're cashed out in terms of false vacua. I guess you could say that the quantum vacuum that permeates space might be an example of a sort of inflaton field, but it's postulated that to have decayed to that state from a state of much higher energy, and we have no indication that those states of much higher states of false vacua minima exist. Secondly, when an inflaton field is grafted on to the solution of Einstein's field equations, then, as Stephen Hawking and Don Page showed, while infinitely many models do exhibit inflation, there are also infinitely many models that don't. So there's no guarantee that inflaton fields, even if they were real, would do what they were invented to do. Thirdly, Roger Penrose has argued that expansion from a generic singularity can still become whatever sort of irregular universe you please, independent of whether there's an inflationary phase. So it's not an adequate explanation of the universe's flatness. Fourthly, you don't get extra confirmation value for explaining why you haven't observed something that's predicted by another theory that is so far not confirmed. And Jerry, you might know the latest on this. The analysis of WMAP data suggested that a preferred direction for large-scale modes of the CMB that disagrees with the uniformity predicted by inflation. So if that anisotropy holds up, not only will inflation's theoretical basis remain shaky, it'll have failed a key experimental test in one of its only real areas of empirical traction. Now, they think that may be related to what, the polar line contributions from the Milky Way, or it still appears to be there. Okay, so, pardon? But string theory, of course it does. Sixthly, the inflaton field has extraordinary fine-tuning problems of its own. First of all, the mechanism for bubble universe formation is supposed to work with general relativity, but there's no intrinsic connection between the inflaton field and the gravitational field as described by general relativity. It's assumed to constrain the process of inflation in such a way that universe bubbles will form from local decay of the field, while the field itself continues to fluctuate and expand. In the creation of these bubbles, the inflaton field has to be shut off and converted to normal mass energy, and the shutoff point is delicate. since the field is postulated to operate in the first about 10 to the minus 37 to 10 to the minus 35 seconds or so of the universe's existence, while causing space itself to expand by a factor of about 10 to the 60th or so. The conversion from the inflation to the preheating area necessary to bring about particle production in an initially cold and empty universe involves a variety of highly speculative models with inflaton preheating coupling parameters that have to be finessed to give you the right results. Depending on the inflationary model under consideration, the energy decay of the inflaton field also has to be fine-tuned to at least 1 part in 10 to the 53rd, and possibly as much as 1 part in 10 to the 123rd. So compared to such levels of precision, the fine-tuning of the Big Bang inherent in the flatness problem, which is only 15 orders of magnitude, seems kind of manageable. And then finally, the massive fine-tuning problem associated with the low universal entropy needed at the Big Bang to produce a universe consistent with the observation is made exponentially worse by inflation. So the initial low entropy condition associated with the Big Bang at the beginning of our universe, which is required for thermodynamics to hold, is extraordinarily fine-tuned. How fine-tuned? Well, without going into the details, Roger Penrose calculated that the observed entropy of our universe required the Big Bang explosion to be fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd power. Now, the denominator of that number is difficult to grasp, but if you were to try to write it out, suffice it to say that when we attach to zero to every proton and neutron in our observable universe, we'd require 10 to the 43 universes our size in order to just write out the number. So the final point to be made, then, is that inflation makes the entropy problem exponentially worse. As Penrose himself observes, if thermalization serves the role of driving background temperatures to equilibrium before inflation starts, then since inflation represents an exponential increase in entropy, this requires the Big Bang to be even more finely tuned in order to account for its present value. In short, inflationary models require the universe to inflate into an entropy that is hyper-exponentially fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd, which requires the pre-inflationary entropy from the very beginning to be essentially hyper-exponentially fine-tuned. On the other hand, if thermalization doesn't play any role in resolving the problem of the uniformity of the cosmic microwave background, then inflation is completely irrelevant to the solution of the problem for which it was invented. All right. So those are some problems with inflationary cosmology. It also generates the Boltzmann-Brain problem, and we'll talk about that as Rob did in a minute. String theory, we don't need to go through what it is. Jerry already talked about that. And M theory. Just some points to note about string theory. Whether it makes unique predictions that are testable, but predictions that aren't also made by other possible models, is a real problem. It doesn't seem to make unique predictions that are testable by current experiments or currently conceivable experiments that aren't also accountable on other bases or other theoretical suggestions. Secondly, it comes in an unlimited number of versions. Even if we restrict ourselves to those gerrymandered to produce a positive cosmological constant, you still have anywhere from 10 to the 500 to 10 to the 1,000 distinct versions. Third, nobody knows whether M theory, which is necessary to understanding the deep structure of string theory, is mathematically consistent, whether it avoids giving contradictory results and assigning infinite values to physical quantities. So we don't know whether a complete and coherent framework exists that will unify the web of conjectures and approximations about strings into a tractable theory. Let's talk about the landscape. If you've got at least 10 to the 500 string solutions, that was initially an embarrassment. Now, which of those stable vacua describes our universe? Why one compatible with life and not any other? Does our universe really have only a 1 in 10 to the 500 or even 1 in 10 to the 1,000th probability of existence? And enter the landscape hypothesis. Let's turn this vice into a virtue by helping ourselves to all of these string theoretic vacua in order to provide a naturalistic anthropic solution to the fine-tuning problem. So the idea, then, is spontaneous decay of metastable features, the moduli of each string solution, would allow it to spontaneously, that is, acausally quantum tunnel, to another metastable inflationary string vacuum, and so on, until the whole landscape gets explored. As we already noted, it's subject to the BGV theorem, and therefore has an absolute beginning in the finite past, which implies a transcendent cause. There's no intrinsic reason to the landscape that necessitates that it begins with a false vacuum energy greater than what we observe. Now, as Jerry pointed out, standard calculations in quantum field theory yield the worst prediction in the history of physics. It was off by 120 orders of magnitude. So you might take that as a prima facie reason for thinking, well, maybe an order one cosmological constant is what we should assume is the starting point, because we find ourselves at 1 over 10 to the 120th of that today, roughly. Nonetheless, in terms of the background, there's no necessity to the supposition that the universe start off in an inflationary state like that. But it is argued that if you start off there, then eventually the whole landscape gets explored by cascading down to lower energies. Okay, there are also reasons internal to the landscape that cast doubt on its tenability. Michael Dine has argued that if a string landscape of metastable ground states exists, it's likely to lead to a prediction of low-level supersymmetry. But he contends in the landscape that the parameters of low-energy physics seem to be random numbers, and if this is true, the landscape isn't a correct description of physics as we know it and should be rejected. And Leonard Susskind and Michael Douglas at Rutgers have tried to reply to this. Douglas's argument is the stronger of the two, and he argues that models involving more than one independently distributed parameter lead to an expectation of high-scale symmetry breaking. But since we don't yet have the mathematical wherewithal to give a definitive answer to how the supersymmetry breaking scale is going to be distributed in a complete ensemble of phenomenologically viable vacua, that is, ones that contain the particles of the minimal supersymmetric standard model, the observations of Dine and others seem to remain solid in that regard and cast doubt on whether the landscape itself is a tenable construction. And then we wind up with the Boltzmann brain problem, essentially. The landscape proposal assumes a mechanism of eternal inflation, and there are going to be an unbounded number of instantiations then of every possible string vacuum. So you're going to get an unlimited number of shots at trying to satisfy the Penrose entropy problem in terms of initial conditions. Now, there are some startling consequences of that. So Alex Vilenkin, for instance, states that in the worldview that has emerged from eternal inflation, our Earth and our civilization are anything but unique. Instead, countless identical civilizations are scattered in the infinite expansion of the cosmos. Indeed, clones of each one of us are endlessly produced throughout the inflationary landscape, for the existence of clones is an inevitable consequence of the theory. Now, those of us who are less enthusiastic might say, if that's the consequence, so much the worse for the proposal. But nonetheless, let's take a look a little bit more carefully at what the consequences are. So we've got this idea that Boltzmann brains can pop out of the thermal vacuum, the quantum vacuum, and the idea of our universe's typicality in that respect. And Rob went over this quite effectively. I don't need to dwell on it. So some calculations lead to free-floating Boltzmann brains infinitely outnumbering normal brains, in which case it becomes infinitely more likely that we ourselves are free floating Boltzmann brains rather than persons with a history living in an orderly universe several billion years old. So that issue in and of itself suggests that the multiverse is falsified because the persons we take ourselves to be are not typical observers within it. Quantum cosmologists, inflationary cosmologists, recognize this to be a problem, and they're trying to come up with solutions, but they can't agree really on whether progress is being made on the problem. And they're doing things like finagling the decay time of the inflaton fields to try to constrain how big they get so that we don't get the Boltzmann brain problem and so on and so forth. No light at the end of the tunnel for them in that respect yet. So, well, there's a sense in which anything with a non-zero probability of happening will happen, and an unbounded number of times at that in an eternally inflating multiverse. A viable typicality condition, if they're ever able to construct one, is going to have to privilege events that we take to be preconditions of our existence. But if we do that, then what are we left with? Well, we're left with a scenario in which the multiverse becomes the solution of last resort for everything else we can't solve. So, Eugene Koonin, molecular biologist, suggests that the multiverse proposal is how we should solve the origin of life problem. The many worlds in one version of the cosmological model of eternal inflation could suggest a way out of the difficulty of the inadequacy of the RNA world hypothesis at the moment. In an infinite multiverse with a finite number of distinct macroscopic histories, each repeated an infinite number of times, emergence of even highly complex systems by chance is not just possible, but inevitable. Specifically, it becomes conceivable that the minimal requirement, the breakthrough stage for the onset of biological evolution, is a primitive coupled replication translation system that emerged by chance. That this is an extremely rare event and occurred on Earth and gave rise to life as we know it is explained by anthropic selection alone. By showing that highly complex systems actually can emerge by chance, and moreover are inevitable, if extremely rare, in the universe, the present model sidesteps the issue of irreducibility and leaves no room whatsoever for any form of intelligent design. And that really is the issue, it would appear. Susskind has remarked, if for some unforeseen reason the landscape turns out to be inconsistent, maybe for mathematical reasons or because it disagrees with observation, then as things stand now, we'll be in a very awkward position. Without any explanation of nature's fine tunings, we'll be hard-pressed to answer the ID critics. Well, why does that bother them? Well, it harks back again to a materialistic worldview. So, Richard Lewontin, reviewing Carl Sagan's last book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark, says this. Our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but, on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. The eminent Kant scholar, Louis Beck, used to say that anyone who could believe in God could believe in anything. To appeal to an omnipotent deity is to allow at any moment the regularities of nature may be ruptured, that miracles may happen. So theism can't be allowed because the regularities of nature may rupture and miracles may occur. What, like conscious brains popping out of the quantum vacuum? Or even bigger things, perhaps even whole universes like our own. So, who believes in miracles now? Following the attempt to give a complete naturalistic explanation, and pushing it to its logical extreme has led to a universe in which anything can happen for no reason. In a theistic universe, nothing happens without a reason. And while nature is not self-sufficient, and therefore not causally closed, any miracles constituted by intelligently directed deviations from divinely maintained regularities are also expressions of purpose. So what we've just seen, then, is that the purposes of scientific naturalism cannot survive the purposelessness that they create. For out of the random void is birthed the end of scientific rationality itself. And I will stop.